Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Adams. In this episode, two expert faculty will answer your questions on optimizing antiretroviral therapy in heavily treatment-experienced people with HIV. Joining me are Dr. Christine Catlama and Dr. Babafemi Taiwo. Dr. Catlama is a professor at Sorbonne University and head of the HIV Hepatitis Clinical and Research Unit in the Department of Infectious Diseases in Paris, France. Dr. Taiwo is the Jean Stollerman Professor of Medicine and Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. For the full online educational program, please visit the link in the show notes for this episode. Now, Dr. Catlama and Dr. Taiwo, let's get started.
Dr. Taiwo, which drugs would you say could be recycled for a patient who is failing a first-line regimen?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think the option would be to think about it from a class perspective. And so starting with the NRTI class, we know that oftentimes 3TC, even though resistance to it is common in patients who have failed initial treatment, it may actually have some activity in part because of the mRNA4 mutation that makes the virus less active. The same is also true of tenofovir. We've shown that when it is used, for example, in the NIDIA study, we saw that it still seemed to have some activity. So we shouldn't throw it away completely as a matter of routine. And of course, there are, we go to the NNRTI class, the first generation drugs like nevirapine and efavirenz, because they have such low barrier to resistance, in patients who've been exposed to NNRTI before, there's really no room for them to be recycled at all. Etravirine, you can think about it, but it's twice a day. And so in the NNRTI class, you're really thinking about doravirine because it can have some activity even in patients who have had some resistance to efavirenz or nevirapine, but it's not something that you can assume. It has to be looked into. Rilpivirine is another drug that often you really cannot use in patients who have failed before because resistance tends to be already present to it, and it has a relatively low barrier against resistance. And going to the integrase inhibitor class, the early agents like raltegravir, subsequently the elvitegravir, again, they suffer from the relatively low barrier against resistance. And so you're looking at dolutegravir, which often in the highly treatment experienced patients, oftentimes they may have existing resistance or integrase mutations, so you have to dose BID. And again, bictegravir is also another really second-generation inhibitor that has a good barrier against resistance. We don't have a lot of experience with bictegravir compared to dolutegravir in patients failing therapy, but one would expect it to be active. And of course, finally, the boosted PI class, in where we really look at boosted darunavir as the agent that can be reused and recycled, because even when some of the resistance mutations have emerged to protease inhibitors, they may not be darunavir-specific mutations. And if somebody actually has darunavir-specific mutations, you can still use darunavir because you can dose it BID and still achieve some level of activity. So amongst the commonly used drugs, these are the drugs that we tend to be able to recycle. There are some other newer agents that would not be in that category because we would not have used them initially.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Catlama, is there any difference in your practice there from what Dr. Taiwo said for recycling agents?
No, I think so. Hello to everybody from Paris. No, I think we will do the same, except we used to, we published that when we needed, we can just move it rather in single, double the dose in a single pill, but you're right. And so doravirine, it's true. There is still, it's probably a little bit more fragile than etravirine, but we really need data on the use of doravirine. But certainly we have the same receipt, darunavir, doravirine, double, BIC. So we can use BIC and add a dolutegravir, for example. So these are the common receipt, I would say. And again, also, the number of drugs will certainly depend on the viral load you have to suppress. But as Dr. Taiwo said, two active drugs, three partially active drugs, just to put the virus down. And we knew with success.
Okay, and do you always include an NRTI in a salvage regimen?
Yeah, I must say at least the 3DC, because there are now plenty of data showing that it's not toxic, it's easy, it's combined also to most of the regimen. And I, like Dr. Otawo, I think tenofovir is a robust drug. And except when there is a full mutation, Q150M, whatever. But it's rare in our context, even with people, from Africa. So we use tenofovir, especially when there is a co-infection or B anticorps, the core, sorry. So there is no damage, no renal things or no osteoporosis. We are really keen on using tenofovir, which is really, for us, robust.
Okay. And Dr. Taiwo, do you usually include NRTIs in your salvage regimens?
Yeah, I think, Dr. Katlama said, one scenario in which I always include tenofovir is if the patient is co-infected with hepatitis B. That is one situation where you absolutely don't want to stop tenofovir by mistake, whether or not it has any activity, no matter what you believe. The other, as to whether I use it in every other context, it depends. Sometimes I use it, but again, I don't have to use it. Remember the options trial that asked the question that if you had an effective regimen constructed, does adding NRTI make a difference in the overall outcome? And it didn't appear to. So you can use it, but you don't have to use it, except the patient has hepatitis B co-infection. As long as the other regimens get you the full complement of active drugs. Again, like was said, you want to make sure you have these two fully active drugs. If one of them includes either dolutegravir, boost, a second-generation integrase inhibitor, or boosted PI that are fully active, then it's okay to have just two fully active drugs. But if you don't have either of those two in your salvage regimen, then you really should aim for three fully active drugs.
And I think we would fully agree from both sides of the Atlantic that we try to keep the regimen as simple, because most of the failing have accumulated resistance, also because of compliance issue. And it's important to think how to combine the best regimen in the simplest form.
Okay. And would you say there's a role for abacavir in salvage regimens?
No, I think in real life, not that much. If you have been exposed to, if you have TAMS mutation and you keep TAMS from the past, the patient with a long history, I think both the strengths of the abacavir are not that much, and the mutation. And personally, it's not our favorite drugs to be recycled. Now you can have a very key reason, penetration in CSF, whatever, to use abacavir. Otherwise, if we are talking about resistance to NRTI, I would say first generation, I will not expect much from abacavir.
Yeah, and I would agree with what Dr. Katlama said, because when you have, let's say, most patients have 184B mutation, we know that mutation actually also affects abacavir activity. Mm-hmm. And whereas that mutation might increase susceptibility to tenofovir, and even from that consideration, and the fact that many of our patients have all kinds of comorbidities that include their cardiovascular risk, et cetera, I think it's really, really rare. And the studies that we've seen recycling NRTIs have tended to be with tenofovir and PTC, et cetera, and the more recent ones for sure. So I agree that it's very rare that you would consider using abacavir in a heavily treatment experienced patient who's failed NRTIs before. Be a very rare situation.
Okay. And if a patient has been off of their antiretroviral therapy for a long time, would you obtain resistance testing before restarting their ART?
If you had never genotyped, you can have, so at least you know from what you start, but you don't expect as much. If it's a wild type genotype, you know that it might not be the truth, because a patient who was discontinued is not anymore under drug pressure. So a mutation may I left. So I would say we do it probably because we are rich and we have the facilities. But I think we can compose regimen without that, because we are not completely, it's not completely reliable, I would say. If there is no mutation, there might be a mutation archives.
That's right. And I think the at least the US guidelines will say that you ideally want to do it while the patient is taking their medication. So if they're taking the failing regimen and they come to you saying and they're failing, that's great to do it, because as Dr. Katlama said, if they're taking their medication, you're likely to see the resistant mutations there. And if they've stopped taking their medication, there's sort of a four-week window when the effect of that might still be present. But somebody who shows up in the clinic a year after their last ART dose, you can do the resistance test, but just remember that you're very likely to miss some of the resistance mutations that are there. And that should be factored in as one considers their treatment plan going forward.
Okay, and speaking of resistance testing, when do you use DNA genotyping for your patients who might have a history of antiretroviral therapy?
First, what's the DNA testing? I think we should remember that the tests that we order routinely in the clinics usually look at RNA, and that's in the context of a viremic patient. But to get resistance testing from RNA, you really need to have virus load that's over 1,000 in most cases. Some labs can go down to 400, but in general, it's hard to see resistance or to do the routine resistance testing if viral load is less than, let's say, 400 copies. And so what do? You can look at DNA. In reality, we tend to first understand the limitations of the DNA testing, because when you look at DNA to look for resistance, it's somewhat of a hit or miss. If you see any resistance mutation there, you believe it because you're seeing it. If you don't see a resistance mutation there, it may or may not be that the mutation is there. So just take the result with a grain of salt. In terms of clinical application, we tend to use it mostly in patients who are actually suppressed and you don't have the full history of their ART exposure, and you're trying to answer the question whether the regimen you have in mind might help. Particularly if it's a regimen like cabotegravir or rilpivirine in a patient who is suppressed. Now, most of the time, we really don't do it. So it is not standard of care to use DNA testing if you're going to switch a patient. You really don't have to do it now in most patients. But in select cases, like situations where you may be considering the drug I just mentioned, you may choose to do it, but again, it's not required. In the heavily treatment experienced patient, if one has somebody with low-level viremia, I'm not talking about 80 or maybe something in the 200s, and you're really concerned that they may be failing, then maybe looking at DNA might help you to see whether there's resistance to the drugs that they're on. Because if you do the routine RNA genotyping, at least in our lab, they will tell you that there is not sufficient virus in the sample for them to do the routine RNA testing. But if you ask for DNA, if their virus load was even undetectable, you can get a result. So for someone with a virus load of 250 that you think they're failing, and you don't know whether which drugs to choose, it might provide some help. But again, with the limitation that I mentioned earlier on.
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree with Dr. Taiwo. I think we use DNA more in highly experienced who are nearly suppressed, because, RNA genotype, we got the result, we get the result by 180 copies, but below not. And so we, you know, as it was said, if there is a mutation, okay. If not, a new, you know, you may try. There is another situation apart from prescribing, seeing if cabotegravir and pivirine would be potential as a main risk is of failing is a prior resistance to an NRTI more than any other. So we may use a DNA, and again, if there is no genotype, we will be more keen to use rilpivirine, even if there have been 20 years ago, nevirapine, and we don't know about it if it was resistant. There is another clinical situation where we have been de-escalating in the recent time the drugs, you know, in patients with 4, 5, 6 drugs, you know, combined because they were like a gigahertz or like this. And we turn, we published this data, ECOVIA, and we use the DNA to see, you know, our choice was to discard the one with no persistent activity and resistance. So it's not routine, but there is still a need to evaluate whether it's useful in the clinic. But I mean, in France, several times we are using this DNA because we have the facilities in a big city. You know, depends where you are, certainly. But, you know, especially for DNA and NRTI and some nukes, and you have to bet which drug can be active because the life is long, and when you treat somebody failing around 50, he has still years to live. So we need to know which drugs, which class of drugs can be still used. And I think this is my guess, and that we cannot discard every drugs and every class. So we need to learn more about how we can, you know, it's again on which marker DNA we can just rely or try to rely.
Thank you. Kathy says, in our clinic, we have had a few cases of urologic breakthrough on cabotegravir and rilpivirine despite adherence. Most have switched from integrase-based regimens, so we have now begun testing for archived resistance for patients with prior history of NNRTI exposure prior to switch. What do you think about this approach?
I entirely agree because we do that. We have a regular weekly meeting to see all the case proposition. So it's not a physician on in whole we can just prescribe. We like to see it together. So we look at whole history, and sometimes it's difficult because we don't have. If we don't have any information about NNRTI exposure and the varload on efavirenz or nevirapine, whatever, we do that and we postpone until we get the information. There is no emergency to use cabo-rilpivirine, and the few failure we've seen were always a missed resistance. So we are very careful, and I agree with this approach. Now, you have many people that have been never exposed, or they have been always fully suppressed. So there's no issue. But the one with a relatively long history, or people coming from countries where NNRTI has been the first life for many years, like in Africa, for example, we are very doubtful, and we do a resistance testing.
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah. I would say, right? If somebody is coming from a prior exposure to NNRTI, one has to be very careful. And I know some clinics now that do this resistance testing routinely, right? Certainly in our practice, if we have any concern about prior NNRTI issues, we will do the resistance testing. It's important to remember, though, that the trial that led to the approval of cabotegravir and rilpivirine, none of them prospectively tested for NNRTI resistance. Or rilpivirine-specific mutations, to be more specific. They did not do that. And as you recall, efforts to understand the factors associated with virologic failure when exposed to cabotegravir viral pivirin led to the identification of a number of risk factors, right? So BMI greater than 30 was one. Presence of rilpivirin-associated mutations was one, which of course was detected retrospectively. And of course, the genotype, subtype A1A6 was another one. And what we learned initially was that you needed to, if you had two of these risk factors, two more, then your risk of failure was increased compared to if you didn't have it. We do know subsequently that a few things are true. One is that virologic failure is very uncommon. So that is one thing we still have to remember. It's still about, you know, in the order of 1 to 2% of virologic failure rate. And that failures have occurred in patients rarely, the key is not rarely, but we've seen failures in people who did not have any of the risk factors. So they didn't have the BMI of over 30, they didn't have resistance to rilpivirin when they looked, and they didn't have subtype A6. So it's still quite a question in the research community and the clinical clinician community too. Why is it that these individuals develop failure despite on-time administration of cabotegravir rilpivirin? Maybe it has something to do with tissue concentration, et cetera. But the rates are very, very low. And we can substitute clinical treatment. Like Dr. Katlama said, it's really just sit down with the patient, dig into their history, see if they've been exposed to NNRTI before. If they've never been exposed to NNRTI and they've never failed before, I think that patient, you really don't need to worry about the intraviral genotype, because especially if you have their baseline genotype showing no transmitted NNRTI resistance, they've never been on NNRTI, they have never failed, then you really shouldn't worry. But when the history is quite complicated, it's not complete, maybe they're from Nigeria and they might have taken efavirenz before nevirapine and they're not sure, et cetera, then you certainly can do the genotype for the DNA. And again, I always caution that it is not for everyone. And Dr. Katlama said there is never an emergency to switch patients to cabotegravir rilpivirin. That's probably true, because these are patients who are suppressed right now. And so we have time to think carefully about what we want to do with them and really not switch them if they have a risk of that's significant. The other thing to never forget is hepatitis B. We mentioned that before. When you're switching to somebody who has co-infection with hepatitis B, you cannot switch them to cabotegravir rilpivirin by itself, because now you're missing tenofovir. So don't forget that you should always check for history of hepatitis B co-infection and consider it if you're going to switch to cabotegravir rilpivirin.
Yeah. To add two points. The first one is, I don't know if in US you use the oral phase, but it could be, you know, we would certainly recommend the oral phase to just get, if there is a failing, get earlier than after the injection. So in that case, we can use the oral lead, you know, with rilpivirin to see whether there might be some archive when we have no data at all, but we presume. The two things I would say is, again, and as the people will not have the tenofovir, it's not only, of course, to be careful about those co-infected, but also those unprotected. And remember, we have still a lot of patients not vaccinated. So if you want, you can just vaccinate the people against that PEEP.
Yes, that is so important.
I'm really pushing all the younger clinicians about the vaccine status. And okay, it's not co-infected, but is it protected?
Right. And actually, one thing I try to do is to use the opportunity of using thinking about cabotegravir rilpivirin to make sure I catch up on all my patients' hepatitis B vaccination status, because the checklist that I go through when I'm thinking about any two-drug regimen includes, is this patient hepatitis B co-infected? If no, is this patient hepatitis B immune?
Exactly.
And if they're not immune, then it's so we should look at it as a really good opportunity to improve our vaccination status. And in terms of whether we use oral leading in the US, I think it's sort of optional, as you know. Yeah. Initially, it was recommended, but subsequently the FDA made it direct to injection, so an option as well, based on evidence showing that there was no difference in the outcomes when people took it immediately without the oral leading, or whether they had an oral leading for a month before going to the injection. And in my experience, many patients prefer to go direct to inject. But again, it's an option that is available to use either with the oral leading or to go directly to injection.
Well, it's 1 month or 2 months. I mean, there are docile. We said that we need to be checked because, okay, cabo-ilp is a great things to be half oral drugs. But in the very few failing case, you got resistance to classes often. So the price to pay is relatively heavy. So we explained to the patient that we have to be sure they have been taking oral drugs for years, usually, and they can expect, and we need to be sure that the drug we are going to give them by injection are sufficient, and you know that we have no idea of their past, and we explain, and usually we can have one month, even 2 months, if we are not, you know, sure enough, whatever. And we said if there is no bleep, nothing happened virologically, you move to cabo-ilp. We are cautious about the resistance.
Very important, yes.
Yeah.
On the topic of cab and rilpivirine, what are your thoughts on using the injectable products for people with extensive history of resistance who may have had some adherence issues to oral therapy in the past?
Also, I mean, cabo-ilp is not recommended. We may face situation, perinatally infected young people, whatever, psychiatric patient, we know that they are terrible and I cannot have a nurse every day to have them helping to take their treatment. They are not institution, but for many reasons, they cannot. And we may consider to start, but not with, you mentioned, you know, a lot of resistance. I would probably go for this approach as it was presented by the Californian team in patients with not too many resistance, because if they miss their appointment, you know, you have to be sure that they are not compliant to the treatment, but they are compliant to some follow-up. It's a little bit different. Unless we have to gather the things, but we have several cases on top of my hand, 6 or 7, where it was really successful, but we inject them at hospital, whereas other people after 3 injection in Europe or in France, you can just go in with private nurse, or you're not forced to be a hospital. Those patients we keep then at the hospital and we do overload at each injection.
Right. I think we'll look at it from both sides and say, why would you consider this approach that is today not recommended? And that was the first thing that was said. It's not recommended that patients who are viremic should be given this cabotegravir-rilpivirine, not to talk of patients who are viremic because they have extensive history of adherence and failure. If they have extensive resistance, then the risk is even much greater. Why might somebody even think about it in the first place? It's because there are certain patients in our practices who, no matter what you do, no matter what you try, they just don't take their oral medications. And those patients continue to contribute to the community levels of HIV, which of course leads to transmission, which of course can also affect the individual. So it has both public and individual implications. So there is really a strong public health imperative to find ways to treat individuals like this. And so before you're going to use it, it has to really be, you know, to consider it. It has to be someone in whom there's really no other option, I think, at this point for them. And this is really a situation where if you didn't give them this intervention, they're going to be in society transmitting and they will come to the hospital with AIDS. But even if you were going to do it, you still have to get over the barrier of cabotegravir is a second generation ATPase inhibitor. But the resistance to bariatric resistance is not the same as dolutegravir or bictegravir. So it is not extremely high. It's great, but not perfect. And ropivirine, of course, we know does not have a very high resistance barrier. And so if you're going to use it, we still have to deal with the likelihood that if it fails, it will fail with, you know, you fail with resistance, both maybe to integrase and also to ropivirine. And that is not a good outcome. And so despite the good results that were shown in San Francisco, I think as a community, we are not quite there in terms of making it a routine thing. I think we are struggling to learn more. I know that efforts are underway to really study more about which specific patient population this might be ideal for. But clearly, there are very select patients who maybe will not and cannot take oral medications, but will come, they come to the clinic regularly and they have no resistance to either cabotegravir or ropivirine. That might be a good option for them. And finally, there are quite a few options now that are coming up with approved medications like lenacapavir that, you know, if you can combine with other agents might be specifically approved for highly treatment experienced patients who are failing with multi-drug resistance. And you have to remember that we have a number of newer agents that at least we have to think about. So great idea, cabotegravir or ropivirine in viremic patients, even if they are failing. We have to be very cautious as our field test, you know, begins to test these new waters.
Okay. Peter asks, I saw one of the guidelines recommending the use of boosted darunavir and dolutegravir with an NRTI backbone as salvage therapy in failure, the reason being to avoid etravirine because it interacts with commonly used drugs for common diseases in the community. Any comment on this combination?
Yeah, I mean, I can go first. I think using boosted darunavir plus dolutegravir is a great combination. And the questionnaire didn't tell us whether these drugs are being used with full activity of either of them. So if you're in a scenario where the dolutegravir has full activity, this is someone who has not seen integrase inhibitor before, fantastic. Even if there's some compromised integrase activity, you can still dose your dolutegravir BID. And you can still also use the boosted darunavir, even if the patient has some resistance to some of the other PIs. And of course, adding the NRTIs would not be a good idea, would be a good idea as we discussed already. But I think that's a potentially strong regimen in patients who are failing, depending on the resistance pattern that you have.
Okay, and then James asks, considering optimizing people living with HIV, both adults and children in our national program suppressed on a second line regimen, with either boosted lopinavir, atazanavir, optimizing by changing to dolutegravir. What would be your thoughts on this?
It's a song online. So, I mean, they are naive to integrase inhibitors, if I understand correctly. Yeah.
And suppressed, I think she said.
And suppressed. So now you have to be sure if, you know, the nukes are sensitive. So you will use either TAF FTC or tenofovir FTC. I mean, TAF with BIC is combined. I think it's a good option. We have no data, I think, in children because it was mentioning children's, but clearly it's good. And you know, even if it's partly effective, if it's really fully sensitive to dolutegravir with 3TC and tenor, alafenavir, diazepoxil. I think it's strong. And one pill, you know, in Africa, it's one pill, TLD, it's very important.
Yeah, and I agree. I think it's a good thing. And remember, there's a study that looked at patients who were well suppressed on a variety of regimens that included boosted PI plus two nukes. And they were switched to, in this case, BICTAF FTC. And the study showed that everybody, I think virtually everybody, remained suppressed. And what was interesting about that study was that when they looked back, quite a number of those individuals actually had resistance to 3TC, and quite a number of them had resistance to tenofovir. And even when people had mutations that conferred, that should have conferred resistance to both 3TC or FTC and tenofovir, they were suppressed on big tough FTC, which is not, again, is similar to some of the other studies we've seen before, and to give really good confidence to persons who are switching to, in this case, if you're using TLD, which is tenofovir with 3TC plus dolutegravir, or you're switching to big tough FTC from boosted PI plus NRTI regimen, even if they have NRTI resistance, as long as they're suppressed at the time of the switch and they're taking their medication going forward, and you educate them about drug interactions, such as, you know, don't take calcium pills, really don't take magnesium, don't take this stuff. Mm-hmm. If you must take your dolutegravir, your big dolutegravir with food, then dolutegravir with food, then that's really, they should be suppressed. You should work very well.
Okay, and then Bernard asks, is there a regimen you could add after failing with cabrilpivirine?
It depends. Failing, first you fail, but do you get resistance to the class of NNRTI and integrase? We had several cases where we did not, they failed by like 300, 200 copies, not, you know, 1,000 copies, and have no resistance. So certainly, for me, we have to go back to oral regimen. Normally, the people were suppressed on a regimen, so if they have no resistance, they can get back and you know, to what they were taking. If there is resistance to cabo and rilp, probably the more simple regimen would be, depends if there is still sensitivity to dolutegravir, you will use BID. I know there is no data, but if you don't want to be on dolutegravir double dose and tenofovir 3TC for other reason, we have some experience with doravirin, if on the genotype the doravirin is sensitive. So doravirin may be an option because it retains sensitivity. So again, it's really, for me, to be discussed. It's not so common. Normally all physicians should be able to call and to discuss with colleagues. It's not, you know, personal things to do what is the best. Because if you already failed two class, you need to be careful for the following to understand what happens. Again, I'm very cautious about CAB. It's a fantastic opportunity, but first look at the past. What is the motivation? We insist on that. Are you ready to go to every 2 weeks to find, you know, the nurses? And it's not a decision that you say, okay, no, I don't want anymore. So, because you never know, and it's really frustrating to be resistant while you were trusting the injection, even if it's rare. So again, don't push too much and just see case by case what could be done. Normally, they are not massively resistant when they are put to cabotegravir and pivirine. So there is option behind, and it can remain a dual therapy or triple. It's not a complete chaos.
Right.
What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I think for some patients, they would need to be on a boosted PI-based regimen, actually for most patients, because resistance to integrase and NNRTI is common. They can still use dolutegravir, perhaps those BID, but many patients would likely need a boosted PI. And you can imagine a simple regimen that might help, the boosted darunavir, for example, plus FTC. That a single tablet regimen might be an option for most patients. And so one of the things that I try to think about when I'm using cabotegravir ribavirin is that, is there any absolute contraindication for the use of Butelvir in this patient? Should they be part of the 1-2% that would have, that we know from trials, would likely fail? And it's very rare that somebody has an absolute contraindication to the use of a boosted PI. But I think it's worth just thinking about it for some time to say, okay, I plan for success, but I am prepared in case somebody has this part of that very small percentage that might need a boosted PI-based regimen or containing regimen down the line should they fail. But again, it's very, very uncommon.
Well, I agree with you. Unfortunately, I think we are the only country in the world where we don't have the combine Butelvir and Darunavir. So, you know, often we have been, those patients we are talking have been already on a PI. Sometimes it's complicated. So we said, oh, you have this cardiovascular risk. So we move them and we switch, And afterwards we say, oh, okay, back to PI. So this is why I agree with you, but it's case by cases. And it depends on the history of the patient. But certainly the most robust compound is Darunavir boosted.
Thank you very much to Dr. Ketlama and Dr. Taiwo. And thank you to our listeners for joining in. To get more from our program, see the link in the show notes. You can read our foundational module, hear specific case examples, and see comments from other experts. Please be sure to check back regularly for more episodes on important infectious disease topics. Thank you and have a great day.